Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our program manager, Mr. P.J. Simmons.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. My name is P.J., and it is a huge honor to be here with all of you. Having met many of you, I'm convinced that if we could just bottle up all the renewable energy that's represented in this room, we would solve the climate crisis and light the world many times over. So if you guys can figure out how to convert that to electricity during the table discussions, that'd be terrific. Thanks. Climate change, by definition, is a global issue. But it's really ultimately about what's going to be happening, what is happening, and will be happening at the community level. And no community understands that better than New Orleans. So I'm sure that you feel as fortunate as I do to actually be here rolling up your sleeves together to get to work here in this special place. As you know, CGI and CGIU are really about action. It's about getting pulling people that are exceptional like all of you together to get things done, not just talk about the issues. And in that vein, what we've tried to do is put together two sessions that will not only enrich your understanding and your capacity to analyze the issues, but also that will hopefully inspire you and give you creative ideas of ways that you can keep putting your talents and your energies to use and to service on these issues now at your universities and for the rest of your lives. Before we dive in, I'm just going to give you a quick overview about how the day is going to be working. We have two sessions today. The second one's at 3:30. And both of them, this morning's and the one in this afternoon, are working exactly in the same way. There's three parts. They're each divided into 30-minute segments. In part one, you'll be introduced to four really exceptional panelists and moderators who will have a conversation up on the stage for 30 minutes. And unlike a lot of meetings where only a few people get a chance to get up to a microphone and ask a question, during that time, while they're talking, you can write down on your pads in front of you any questions that come up to you, pass them to your table facilitators, the person who's sitting with the computer. They're going to type them in, and in real time, a theme team over there in the back is going to be working hard to assemble those for the panel so that they can take a break, work on the panel, work on responses to your questions while you're all having table discussions. So I'd just like to take a moment and ask all the table facilitators to stand and also the theme team to stand. All these folks are volunteering their time, and they came from far distances to join you. So thank you. So after that first 30-minute segment, in part two, we're going to turn the floor over to you, and you'll have 30 minutes to talk with all the exceptional people at your table about a particular discussion topic, which I'll introduce a little bit later. Your table facilitator will be taking notes during your conversation, again, sending them in real time over to the theme team, who'll be assembling that, and I'll be reporting later, a little bit later on what some of the big themes are that came out of those discussions. In part three, we'll call the panel back for the last 30 minutes. They'll have a chance to start responding to some of the questions that you raised. I'll come back up in the middle, interrupt them about 12 minutes into it, give a report back on what all of you sent over to the theme team, and then we'll give them a chance to close and respond to those themes that you raised. So without any further ado, it's my great pleasure to introduce a really extraordinary panel of people, beginning with Christine Ibes Singer, the Deputy Executive Director of E&Co. Nikki Henderson, who is the Research Fellow at Green for All. Peggy Liu, founder and chairperson of JUICE, which stands for Joint U.S.-China Cooperation on Clean Energy. Jigar Shah, the Chief Strategy Officer and founder of Sun Edison. And your moderator, GP Bud Peterson, the Chancellor of the University of Colorado at Boulder.
Well, thank you, PJ, and welcome to our panelists, and thank all of you for coming. I think all of us are well aware of the importance of global warming, sustainability, climate change, and recognize the importance of this particular issue. One of the things that we'd like to address today is not only the challenges that this issue brings, but also the opportunities that it presents. I think the key question, or one of the key questions for the panel, is as we look at these challenges and opportunities, how will they affect the range of people in the country, in the world, the range of socioeconomic classes, and what impact will it have on not just the wealthy, but also on the underprivileged? how will this particular issue present opportunities for employment, for new businesses, for new ventures, and how will those new businesses, opportunities, and new ventures impact people all across the country and all around the world? It's interesting to me. We've got a remarkable panel here, and I want to start off and kind of set the stage with a quote that was made by Van Jones, who was the founder of Green for All. He stated that, quote, "The green economy has the power to deliver new sources of work, wealth, and health to low-income people while honoring the earth. If you can do that, you just wiped out a whole bunch of problems. We can make what is good for poor, underprivileged kids good for the polar bears, and at the same time, good for the country and good for the world." And with that, maybe we'll start the discussion. Nikki, your group, Green for All, has been a national campaign, has been on a national campaign for green-collar jobs. What are green-collar jobs, and what are the chief challenges we face in developing economic options for low-income and developing communities?
Thank you. And before I start answering the question, can I get everyone to close their eyes for a second? Taking a deep breath and let it out. Okay, one more time. Deep breath in and let it out. Thank you. Part of my background is in theater, and one thing I learned is that if your attention span as a human being is around 30 seconds, it's always good to refocus and recenter before you start listening to someone talk, especially when you go room to room listening to people talk. So thank you for humoring me. And getting into what a green-collar job is, how many of you have heard Van Jones speak before? Okay, good, good. So this will be new information for a lot of you. A green-collar job is a job that engages the environment, our surrounding environment, in terms of retrofitting, in terms of agriculture, in terms of energy efficiency, all those kinds of things. And a job that also gives someone the opportunity for upward mobility. So it's not just coming in on the bottom level and staying on the bottom level. It's giving someone the training, the hard skills, the soft skills, so that they can get in on the bottom level and continuously move up in the ranks. And if this job is something that provides both of those, it counts as a green-collar job. We're still very much in the process of identifying all the different types of green-collar jobs because, as you can imagine, it's a very wide open term at this point, and it's being thrown around in a lot of different ways. And so some of the chief challenges of these green-collar jobs is that, for those of you who have heard Van Jones speak, it's very inspiring stuff listening to the work of creating upward mobility for people. You've got people who need jobs. You've got a country that needs to be energy independent. You've got means of doing so. You've got technology. You've got training. You've got all these different pieces. And the question is how to bring them all together practically. And that's probably the chief challenge of green-collar jobs, is being the broker between people sitting at a table with different interests who need to come together in a practical way. So a good example is when you get a bill passed and then you wait for the money to be appropriated and you've got a whole bunch of people screaming in your ear, "We need a job. You've been telling us the same thing for the past 2 years and I haven't received any training." Or new situations come up, you know, some that I've just heard about, where you have an employer who's getting strapped with a bunch of administrative costs to ensure something that's already being done, but there's not necessarily trust on all sides of the table. So you've got all these different things that come up between people who have very real interests, and so it's getting from the vision to the real work. And then something that is on an even more social justice level is when you've got the people who need the jobs. How do you get them to go get the training? A good example of that, my parents run a foster family agency in Los Angeles, California. I see emancipating foster youth every day. The 18-year-olds who come out of the foster system having been in 15 different homes, and 50% of foster youth that emancipate in America are homeless after 5 years because they can't cook, they can't write checks. There's some very basic skills that they're missing. And green-collar jobs is trying to address that population too. That kind of soft skills training tends to be very expensive, a little more expensive than the average training that goes down for jobs. But a lot of the question is, at that point, what are the values of green-collar jobs? And is the political will going to get behind securing whatever resources are necessary to make sure that everyone in this country who does not have access to a job gets that access and gets the training necessary for it?
Great. Thank you very much, Nikki. I think when people think about green-collar jobs, they envision low-paying jobs, jobs that are not very high-paying and limited opportunities. Is that the case is that what you see with Green for All?
Absolutely not. So green-collar jobs is engaging the question of what does it take to access every rung of the ladder? But a green-collar job is also speaking of someone who started at the bottom and made it to the top, or someone who started in the middle and then further made that up to the top, right? So a green-collar job, the point of a green-collar job is that it's entry-level with upward mobility. If the upward mobility piece isn't there, it's not considered a green-collar job.
Great. Thank you. Christine, your company invests in local clean energy suppliers in developing countries. Traditionally, these types of opportunities require capital, and developing countries often have limited access to that capital. How can you convince investors that supplying clean energy, creating a sustainable environment, is a good investment and something that they should be involved in?
Thank you, Bud. The answer is the triple bottom line. E&Co invests in small and medium-sized businesses in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. And we invest debt and equity and capacity building, business training, business plan development, market aggregation services and such to enable the enterprise and the entrepreneur to put together what we call a bankable business plan. We attract capital to invest in this space that is not served by local financial institutions in the countries within which we work, because we're able to tell our investors, be they high net worth individuals, institutional players, multilateral development agencies, faith-based community, the World Bank, and others, that you invest in these companies because they're delivering triple bottom line results. We're providing financial returns. We have a portfolio that provides over an 8% return on capital. But we're also providing access to clean energy for over 4 million people. We're offsetting over 4 million tons of carbon today, which will grow to offsetting more than 25 million tons of carbon by 2012. And at the end of the day, when we invest in an additional 370 companies by the end of 2012, our businesses will be bringing clean energy access to more than 25 million people in the markets within which we're working. That's just moving the new energy paradigm along, because if you think about it, the reason we're focusing on energy and bringing in investment is because with energy, anything is possible. Without it, very little is. So when you talk about economic development, you talk about job generation, you talk about education, health, vaccine refrigeration, you can't do it without energy. Cooking. In the time that I've been speaking now, at least 4 or 5 people have died from indoor air pollution in the very markets within which we work as a result of the fumes coming off of the stoves that they're using, burning charcoal or firewood or animal dung. 2.4 billion people cook with traditional fuels in the markets within which we work. 1.6 billion people don't have access to electricity. So when you think about the energy opportunity and the energy need, two things are apparent. The first is you have to engage the local entrepreneur. That's the lever of economic development. It's what's proven itself not only in the United States but also in Europe. These are men and women who want to earn an income, who want to have jobs, and what better way to engage them but in the provision of a life-changing service to their communities and their villages within which they work. So I think the way that we engage private investment, which is the second thing that's missing in this marketplace, is by evidencing that you're not just getting a financial return on your investment, but you're also having significant impacts on people and planet.
Well, it's interesting. The investors typically look at the bottom line, and you talk about the triple bottom line. So this is investors that have an opportunity to make a profit for their companies to be successful, but also to benefit people all over the world. Today in this country, there are about 8.5 million green jobs, what we perhaps call green jobs, Nikki, but they may not all have the opportunity to advance. It's estimated that by 2030, that number will grow to 40 million. But that pales in comparison when you talk about the number of jobs that are and opportunities that are available in China. And Peggy Juice has worked on creating jobs and creating clean energy in China, the probably the fastest growing economy and the fastest growing consumer of energy in the world. How do we take the seeds of China's growth and expand on that and learn from the things that are happening, the things that Juice is doing in China, and translate that both here to the United States and around the rest of the world?
So first of all, welcome to CGIU, everybody. I flew all the way from Shanghai, China, to come see you today.
Last night.
Yes. And I'm leaving on a flight at 7 p.m. to go back to Beijing. So I'm really glad to be here to spread the message about what's happening in China, to tell you that you have a chance to impact China and therefore the world, to help China become a sustainable country and therefore help the world become cleaner. So let me just paint a picture, because a lot of the people, even the people in China working in the energy field, don't know some of the basic statistics. So yesterday I was driving on the bus. The bus driver was saying there's 300,000 people in New Orleans, about 600,000 people at peak. Now in China, there's 1.3, almost 1.4 billion people in the country. So there's 650-plus cities, official cities. According to McKinsey, there's actually about 850 cities that walk, talk, and breathe like cities. And an average city in China is about 4 million people. Now, the city that I live in has 20 million people, okay, including migrants and such. That's Shanghai. And Shanghai, if you haven't been there before, I welcome you to come visit. It's like a modern New York City. Okay, it's not the China that you're envisioning. It is like a modern New York City except the size of Los Angeles. Okay. Right now, China is the number one emitter of greenhouse gases. It's surpassed now the U.S. And I'm sure you guys have heard the statistic, but we're building about 1 to 2 coal-fired power plants a week. Okay. We're building enough floor space about the same size as Manhattan every year. Okay, two Manhattans, actually, sorry. And so this type of growth, this type of scale, is happening at a pace that you really can't understand until you land in China. And you look at the number of cranes there, and you see the pollution that's coming from the smokestacks, and you see the cars that are getting, sort of the number of cars are getting worse and worse every day. Now, luckily, Chinese people are very thrifty by nature. And I think they consume about a fifth or less of the energy that an average American does. But that rate of consumption is growing very, very quickly because they're getting richer. Okay, so this is a huge problem. So don't think butterfly wings when you're thinking about China. Think about a sledgehammer or a steamroller that's just going to bulldoze the pollution. A third of the pollution in California is coming from China. Okay, because smokestacks don't respect borders. So what can you do about this? What is Juice doing about this? So Joint U.S.-China Cooperation on Clean Energy is a nonprofit NGO, one of the very few in China that are focused on this issue of accelerating China's progress towards a clean country. Now, part of this is because, you know, it's a communist country and they're just getting used to NGOs, et cetera. Part of it is because China's government has just now, over the last 12 months, really, I believe, truly, become one of the most progressive governments in the world towards green policies. How many of you guys know that we just banned plastic bags? So starting in the summer. All right, how many countries can do that? They are working on a new China energy law draft. They have an 11th five-year plan that says by 2010, the end of 2010, they need to increase energy productivity by 20% and reduce emissions by 10%. Does the U.S. have, you know, the same type of goal? Now, they might not reach this. They don't really know how to reach this goal. But the fact that the government has actually even started to think about this and is this ambitious is a great start. However, unlike the U.S., where it's really a policy problem, right, to move things forward, you need to get the government leaders to really become leaders themselves and move things forward. In China, it's a human resources problem. Now, this is, ties back to our topic of economic opportunities in China and across the world. So in China, the main problem is that you've got these green policies, but you don't have an energy workforce that can actually implement these green policies. So think about the contractor who doesn't know how to install weatherproof membranes behind insulation properly, or the person who's buying insulation and thinks the counterfeit pink fluffy stuff is just as good as the Owens Corning or BASF pink fluffy stuff. Or the mayor of Harbin, who doesn't know how to get his hands on the latest and greatest technologies. This whole supply chain, okay, from government on down to the person who's using the buildings, doesn't know how to implement these green policies. So the opportunities that JUICE is trying to catalyze is collaboration, is training of this workforce, is really creating of a whole new workforce. It's transitioning old companies like Honeywell used to be an industrial company. Now it wants to be known as an energy company, right? So transitioning Nike, and they want to green their whole supply chain in China, helping them. So Nike, just to give you an example, each one of their factories has 20,000 people in them. Okay, so talk about a green workforce, right? That's a lot of green collar jobs. And it's all upwardly mobile because China is the number one market for clean tech, for any energy products. Now, the opportunity for you all sitting here is not necessarily that, you know, I'm trying to say move to China and learn Chinese and, you know, help JUICE on the ground, but there's a lot of opportunities that China can use your help, your research knowledge, your collaboration skills, your ability to bridge cultures, your ability to digest, synthesize best products and knowledge of products, and then bring them to the key decision makers in China. That's essentially what JUICE is trying to do. We're a bridge, an international and multidisciplinary bridge. So I'll leave you with one thought. So years ago, when you asked a room of Nobel Prize winners how long it would take to sequence the human genome, they all said about 100 years. So 10 years later, we sequenced the human genome. Now, this was only possible through massive international and multidisciplinary collaboration. The same type of collaboration now needs to be applied to helping China develop sustainably. And this can happen outside of China, going in and in helping increase trade with China, as well as within China and going out.
Great. How many of you have been to China? Oh, that's a lot more than I would have expected. Unless you've been to China and have some understanding and some comprehension of the number of people and the dramatic changes that are underway there, it's really hard to imagine. We think of being one in a million in the United States as being special, but if you're one in a million in China, there are 1,300 just like you. It is just incredible. One of the key issues, I think it was Machiavelli who said, first man creates wealth and then creates virtue. And as the economy in countries like China changes, I think the challenge is going to be to try to create economies that are friendly, that are economically sustainable. People have a tendency to worry about eating and surviving first, and then are concerned about the quality of their environment. And I think that's going to be the real challenge for us in developing countries, is how do we develop the economic climate and the opportunities at the same time we take care of the environment and do it in a way that's sustainable. So it'll be interesting. Jigar is co-founder and chief strategy officer, and you're much too young to be either of those, but as co-founder and chief strategy officer of Sun Edison, how do you get the price of solar energy down so it works for developing nations? It's easy to think of solar applications on houses in Burbank or New York or Boulder, Colorado, but how do you create an environment in which solar energy is affordable for people across all socioeconomic classes?
Well, But thanks for the question. What I would say is, I mean, how many people in the room here are engineers? I am as well. The problem with solar is not technology. If you hear something today on the panel, green tech, clean tech, whatever you want to call it, the problem is not technology. We've been working on it for a long time. I remember going to my mom probably when I graduated from college, which seemed like yesterday, and telling her I wanted to do solar energy, and she thought I was crazy and thought I'd be having to work two part-time jobs to support my solar habit. I think that today, solar energy, I think, SunEdison probably employs 500, close to 500 green jobs. And most of those people are, upwardly mobile and getting promoted from, getting in on the ground floor to becoming construction managers and project managers and then program managers and then moving up the chain on that. What I would say is that the problem with solar is the value of solar. The problem with solar is not the cost of solar, right? So if you were to go to somebody during Hurricane Katrina and say, who had a solar system on their roof with battery backup system, and their house is still running and has electricity, which happens all the time in Florida, by the way. Every time they get by a hurricane, the people who have solar panels on their roof actually have power. They're not out because diesel and diesel fuel runs out after a week and a half, and they just have no way to run their diesel generator or anything else. So the person whose house you go to be able to use a telephone or whatever else is the guy with the solar panels on his roof. So what is that worth, right? Or when you go to a place like, West Bengal, where they grow a lot of tea, and there's a lot of poisonous snakes there, and 23 people die per year in that village because it takes 2.5 hours by bullet cart to take the people who get a snake bite to the clinic, and they all die because of that. So now they've got a solar panel with a vaccine refrigerator, and now they get cured on the spot. So, the value of solar is a problem. So now, let me make it a little bit more tangible for those of you who might be more familiar with the U.S. So Utah, for instance. Utah has, Rocky Mountain Power just announced that they want to have a 11% rate increase, which is pretty high, and, for people like me who live in Maryland, it's a 72% rate increase we had last year. Now, this 11% rate increase is very, very special because it's not tied to fuel. It's not tied to natural gas. It's not tied to coal prices going up. It's tied to the fact that steel, concrete, labor, et cetera, is just more expensive. So this 11% rate increase is for the added growth of people moving to Salt Lake City. Now, what I would say to you, and, there's not enough time here in this panel for me to get into all the details, but if I can raise people's electricity rates in Salt Lake City by 5.5% instead of 11%, am I cheaper, right? I think I am. So now I believe right now that I could raise people's electricity rates in Salt Lake City by 5.5%, switch 10% of all their energy to solar power, meet the entire needs of all their population growth for the next 10 years that Rocky Mountain Power wants 11% rate increase for. And it's not just solar. We would include smart grid architecture like ice storage and advanced meters and energy efficiency and all these other wonderful things together. But, but if that's true, then we can solve global warming, right? I mean, if that's true, then clean tech and green tech is cheaper. Now, the cost of solar panels are coming down. For the last 10 years, they've come down by 5% a year, and they will continue to come down by 5% a year just because from my engineering background, it's just learning curve theory. Every doubling of cumulative production leads to an 18% reduction in cost. And so that's just, whether it's cell phones or whether it's solar panels, it's the same thing. It's just our growth rate's not as fast as cellular technology, so we have to wait a little longer. But I do want everyone, I want people in this room to ask questions. Solar and these other technologies are not more expensive. They just are viewed under a different paradigm from traditional energy technologies. And until we actually change that paradigm, I don't believe we're going to actually, stabilize carbon emissions by 2015 without that paradigm shifting.
Great. We have just a couple minutes left, but when you look out in the audience, you see a group of wonderful advocates, perhaps one of the most marvelous collections of green advocates that I've ever been around. If you have one thing that you'd like to convey to this group before us today, what would that one thing be? What one thing would you tell this group about how they can impact the communities in which they live, the nation, and the world?
I'll start.
You're wearing the green jacket.
Yeah, I've got the. I'm going along with the St. Paddy's Day spirit. I think the one thing I'd like to say is innovation doesn't necessarily mean you have to start something completely new. By that I mean when you look at what IANCO is doing, which is basically taking the Small Business Administration of the United States and applying it to developing country locations in clean energy technology. That's the innovation. We're leapfrogging something that's worked somewhere else, and we're making it happen. And so often when you're thinking about how do you get involved, what do you want to do, it is often talking with other people and figuring out not just what the next best thing is, but what's working and how do I take my skill set to that and make it even better. And I think that's what the success of IANCO has been. We've not created a whole new system of investing and providing clean energy services. We've just taken something that works, applied it slightly differently, and then provided it the capital and the inputs it's needed to grow and get to scale. And that's one last comment I'll make. Getting to scale on most anything we're talking about here truly is the innovation of this generation. Thanks.
Nikki, Peggy?
You know, I think the story of Van Jones and the Ella Baker Center and how that transitioned into an organization that had green in the title is probably my best message to you. Because Van and his partner, Diana, started doing police brutality work in Oakland. They started doing prison industrial complex work and silenced the violence when it came to gang violence. And this human rights work with the predominantly African-American community somehow sparked a how do we fix this situation bug in both of them. And then that evolved into Van seeing an opportunity in green jobs and green economy, and that transitioning his human rights work into Green for All. And so I think I meet a lot of young people nowadays, and I'm one of them, who is a social justice junkie and human rights junkie. And I care about the science, and I care about economics, and I care about politics, and I care about all that stuff, but I really want to help people. And I think if you have that bug, you can do good work. And there are organizations where the people are just like you. And we hire other people who are the economy junkies and the political junkies, and you don't have to house all of that yourself. Collaborate. It's about knowing what your strength is, much in the same way. Knowing what your heart and soul speaks to, and then finding a place where you fit.
Yeah, and I'll echo that a little bit. When Juice first got started, what we did was we asked a team of McKinsey folks in China, Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Frankfurt in the U.S., to come together for about a month and a half. And they did some pro bono work to look at the entire China and U.S. energy landscapes to see where can an NGO make the greatest difference. And what we realized very quickly was, one, we have to focus on China because that's the area of greatest impact, but also, two, that a point solution or point technology is not what's going to win the game. And there's a lot of people that are working on technologies already. But the interesting thing is that the current technologies, if you're just to apply current technologies, we could have that 20% energy savings. So what's the problem in China, and maybe the U.S., but specifically for China, it's about collaboration. It's about taking all the scattered knowledge of the last 50 years around the world and then bringing them together and then synthesizing it in a digestible format for the leaders in China so that they can apply it. This is something that anybody in this audience can do, because I assume you guys are all very smart and you have the ability to communicate, to collaborate, to do research. Actually, that single skill, I think, is one of the most important skills for leaders of the flat world. So think about how to apply that skill to current technologies, not just new technologies.
And Jigar, quick thoughts?
Sure. I guess what I would say is that this is going to be enormous. for those of you who want to make a difference, this is a place to make a difference. This is on the scale of building the Trans-Alaskan pipeline, on the scale of putting a man on the moon, on the scale of all of these things. And it's going to happen, regardless of, regardless of how it happens, it's going to happen. And so there's definitely a role for all of us to play. Just to give you one anecdote, my company put solar panels on the roofs of, let's say, Walmart, Kohl's, Staples, Whole Foods, Costco, Macy's, JCPenney's, Neiman Marcus, all these guys, right? So they all have solar panels on their roofs. To just complete the programs that we have under contract with them by 2017, 2018, I have to build 65,000 megawatts of solar on their roofs. To do that, I'm going to have to employ 455,000 job years of labor, not just installing panels, but sales, marketing, everything else. So this is my challenge in front of me now for the next 10 years, and it's just going to get bigger as other people decide to sign contracts with us, et cetera. So this is enormous, right? It starts locally. It starts with what you want to do, what you're really good at, how you want to contribute to this movement. But there's room for everyone in here. So don't, this is a collaborative process here. There's room for everyone to help make this happen.
Great. Thank you very much. At this point, I want to invite PJ to come back up, and he's going to kind of tell us how this works from this point forward. PJ?
Thanks, Bud. Thanks to all the panels. Sorry. So we've gotten about 100 questions from all of you. You've all been working really hard. And now is kind of the exciting moment when a lot of you can take what you've heard and start taking your own experiences in your lives and your campuses, sharing with each other your own ideas about what this means to you in your own lives, what it means on your campuses. We have a question to prompt that discussion. And I should also say by way of introduction, too, that the second panel this afternoon, for those of you that haven't seen in the program, is called Building the Groundswell for Change. So we'll be asking a lot of questions about movement building and getting more people engaged. But this one, this panel, we've asked our panelists to talk about this broad topic of how do we turn, in a sense, lemons into lemonade. How do we take these challenges of climate change and translate them into opportunities, particularly on the economic side? So hopefully you've heard a lot of stuff to sort of spark conversation and get you started. The question we'd ask you to think about at your tables is what can campus communities, meaning students, faculty, and administration, do to reduce heat-trapping gases and promote clean energy while also advancing economic justice for all? So what can we do to help solve these problems while also pursuing an economic justice agenda? We leave you, we turn the floor to you for the next half an hour. Your table facilitators are going to be working hard to get that information to the theme team, and we'll see you in half an hour. Thank you.